This is Circulating Ideas. I'm Steve Thomas. My guest today is Angie Manfredi. She's the head of youth services for the Los Alamos County Library System in Los Alamos, New Mexico. You can find her blog at fatgirlreading.com or follow her on Twitter at Miss Kubelik. Welcome to the show, Angie.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Steve.
We were actually in the same room together at ALA at the Prince Awards, but we did not meet. And I was also rooming with a friend of yours, Thomas Malik, and yet we still did not meet.
That sounds like ALA to me.
Yes. So do you have that happen a lot when you're at conferences where you're people that you know sort of online and you know they're around, but you don't ever hook up with them?
Definitely. And certainly as I've expanded circles, you know, like, so when you used to only be with the youth services people, then it was easier to run into them. But as I've come to know more academic librarians and more special librarians and more school librarians, then it gets harder and harder to be in the same place at the same time. So that's always a downer. But it's also part of ALA that you are trying to get as much in as you can, but you just can't always connect with the people that you get to connect with online, which is why being online is quite awesome.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Do you find a lot, but before Twitter, Facebook, all this stuff took off, blogs and everything, did you find professional development to be a harder thing to?
So for me, one of the things is I've been on Twitter since 2008. So I'm sort of an early adopter. So literally some of the first people I was friends with on Twitter were librarians. I joined Twitter because people were doing it in Library World. Specifically, YALSA was really promoting it at their inaugural 2008 YA Lit Symposium, which I was a presenter at. And that's how I even really got on Twitter. So for me, always, that's been an integral part of my professional learning network is online. And I think that really helped me kind of roll with it. And it certainly would have been more difficult because of my physical location, which is I live in a very large state, New Mexico, geographically large, where it's hard to get together in person with other librarians. And that's difficult when your state is from one end to the other. It's 8 hours to drive from one end of the other to New Mexico. So that's hard. And the online element takes care of that.
And are you able to attend conferences a lot? Do you attend? I know you're at ALA. I mean, do you try to attend most of the conferences?
I do. I like to have a reason, quote unquote. I just made finger quotes. Can't see it, but I just made finger quotes. I like to have a reason to attend, but even if I don't, I still try to make it a priority because it's really incomparable and it's the best way to network with people in person. And I'm lucky that my workplace lets me take it as work time. I don't have to take it off as leave. And before we had some budget difficulties, they would pay for you know, some of my attendance. But even still, it's a thing that personally I invest in, but I acknowledge that not everybody can do that, especially when, you know, for me, like from New Mexico, it took me all day to get to Philadelphia, you know, like, it's a long flight. You know, I had to have a connection. It was a six and a half hour flight to like round trip to get there. So that's a significant, you know, that's a significant flight. That's a significant
right.
time
yeah.
period. It's a whole day.
How far away is Las Vegas?
Oh, that I can drive, which I might do. Yeah. But it's an hour flight, which actually ends up taking like 5 minutes because we change time zones. So you'll leave New Mexico at like 7:15 and get there at 7:45. Like, so that's nice.
It seems much quicker.
It is.
Yeah. It's like my wife and I went to New Zealand and you kind of get there like the day before you left or something. And it's confusing. Mm-hmm. You'd cross the date line.
Well, and that was the good part about coming back from Philadelphia. The flight felt much shorter, but on the way there, it was, you know, you lost 2 hours time zone wise and then the physical time of flying. So that is difficult, but it's a trade-off that every person has to make individually for themselves. But that's why I like Twitter and Facebook and blogs, because if you can't do that, that's a way for you to see what happened there and to connect with the people who maybe can't go themselves as well.
And is there something about Twitter in particular that enables a certain kind of conversation for you? Because I know a lot of times it's educational and entertaining when you really get going on a good little snark filled rant.
I do.
Is there something about Twitter in particular that helps you express yourself that way, like as opposed to going to your blog and writing a long blog post about it? What is it about Twitter do you think that?
I really enjoy the 140 characters because I think first of all, of course, I love being long-winded. You know, I could do that for days, obviously. But for me, Twitter is a way to really get to what you're saying. So my undergraduate degree is in creative writing. And one of the things I really struggled with, and my professors always used to say, is like, you've got to, the number one rule of creative writing is show, don't tell. Stop telling me about what's happening in your story and show me what's happening in your story. And so for me, Twitter kind of really allows me to show and not tell. This is exactly what I'm saying. This is exactly what I mean. And even if I have to do it in a series of tweets, which I usually do, I think the flow of how you read Twitter really even encourages that. So for me, I think it's made me sharper. And it's also made me, I come up with a larger statement of what I want to say, and then I structure around that. So I think it's in a way helped me do what I never could do in undergrad, which, you know, is get to it, as opposed to being like, I'm going to tell you this story and, oh, here's 20 pages about how her dress looked. No, no time for that. Like, get to why she's wearing the dress. So that's been helpful.
Well, and it seems like you, from looking at your blog, you generally use it a lot more for like writing book reviews and talking more about specifically books.
Indeed. And the other thing too is sometimes even with all my blurbs, I want to cover something a little more in depth. And so that is what my blog is good for. And I've had it for several years, 2, 3, or 4, but there have been periods when I've been really inactive with the blog, but that's never really happened with Twitter. I've maintained that. And I think part of that is tied to the 140 limit. Even though I have made an effort in the past year to really keep up with my blog and post at least a couple times a month, just because I felt like I didn't want to live in a world where I was only a blurb. So I've tried to do that. I've had some issues hosting it. I'm switching hosts, which has been like nightmare time. So that it kind of went inactive again. But my goal is to get back to it and, you know, kind of give myself that other outlet as well.
Well, the thing that's nice about Twitter, I think, too, is that you get sort of instant feedback, because you can start saying something, but it turns into a conversation, and it can really make it a much more meaningful conversation than even what you had started.
It's true. And I use that to kind of deal with one of my frustrations, which is such a weird, creepy person thing to worry about. But I'm always like, I'll say like 5 things that are all related to one conversation, and a person will retweet like one or favorite one. And I'm like, you're missing the entire context of what I'm doing here. It's like a much larger picture. But that's one of the things that I think you learn about Twitter, is that it's a lot about letting go of how you want to interact with the platform and understanding that other people interact with it in their own ways, which has also been good for me. You know, that was another lesson I needed to learn about. You can't make everybody, you know, read what they want to read. So yeah, and they can't make me. So that's been beneficial as well.
Yeah, it gets a little confusing sometimes if you're using the official Twitter client because of the way they do the threading conversation.
Yes.
If you're responding to one comment and keeping up with comments now, but.
Well, and then it'll say C25 and you click on that and you get to see like 2. And you're like, this feels like not complete.
Yeah. So. Doesn't quite work as well.
I thought you said 25. So that's more of Twitter's glorious design. So
are you the same way in person? I mean, do you have the same sort of conversations with people? And
I think so. I would like to think so. I'd like to think my online persona translates pretty well to my real life persona. If anything, I think probably I am I am calmer in real life because I am unable to use caps lock as much as I wish. And you know, the person who lives with me, my roommate, she's lived with me for about 2 years. We met originally online years ago via personal blogs, and then we met in person actually at ALA New Orleans. And she's a school teacher. So then she came to visit me, and she ended up moving out here and getting a job. So I always tell people, clearly, you know, my online persona, our online personas meshed well, and then our real life personas seem to be very similar. So I think that's a pretty good evidence that the person that I am online pretty much is the person I am in person.
Yeah, I think the most interesting people to follow on Twitter especially is if you're being authentic. I mean, you don't want to have somebody who's just kind of those the accounts that are just tweeting out boring information. That's and that's why when you know, like, official libraries accounts are tweeting things out, you don't want to just hear, oh, look, we're closed today. Oh, look, here's a book that we just added to the catalog. You mean, you want to have a conversation. And
you do, or else Twitter gets boring really fast.
Yes.
So, and I think that's very similar for authors. That's a thing we talk about a lot, about following authors. Like, you don't want to follow an author who only ever talks about their book, even if it's literally the greatest book ever written. If right. J.K. Rowling was on Twitter and all she ever talked about was writing, like, I would be bored, because I want to know about, like, what are you doing with Pi? What are your feelings about television? Like, that's, to me, is a really important part of Twitter, is that it's more than just one thing, no matter what that one thing is. Like, you want to hear the full, I don't follow people I don't think are interesting, regardless of if they're the most important author in the world. I am just not going to do that. I have too many other people that I want to have interesting dialogue with. So,
well, and if there's something important about that author that comes up, it'll come up through your stream anyway.
Right, so. Right. Instead of hearing them endlessly promoted in one circle, you know, so that's just not relevant to me.
So you talked about this a little bit, but do you find that social media is more important for a librarian who's in a rural area, who doesn't have
those
opportunities to meet in person that you really need? Because I feel like that conversation with other professionals is really important to keeping our energy up for the profession.
Oh, definitely. You know, because, and even that's how I discovered at the time, Corey Eckhart, who now works in Houston, but at the time she worked in Gallup. We had, which is about 4 hours from me and the other in New Mexico. But until we had met online, we had no opportunities to actually meet in person. And we really became friends and became colleagues, New Mexico colleagues, online first, before we met in person, before we had ever met. Because there's just, like, you just don't have the opportunity to do that. And I'm friends with other librarians in New Mexico that I met on Twitter that we've only met in person once or twice. Not that many, because there's, you know, New Mexico is poor and rural in many places. But if it wasn't for that, I think it would be extraordinarily difficult to connect as often and on the level that you want. If you are not in a branch, if you're not in a system with branches, if you're by yourself, you know, in the middle of nowhere, you can befriend anyone. You can befriend any colleague on Twitter and say, how do you do this where you are? And how can I do this where I am? And it's hard to explain that sometimes to people who are like, there's 15 youth librarians in my system. And I'm like, well, I don't have a system. So, you know, there's me and my colleagues. So without that networking, both through Twitter or through blogs, and through Facebook, I think a rural librarian's job would be much more difficult.
And do you think on a national level that rural libraries are kind of given the shaft a little bit, that they're not kind of thought about as often as the libraries that, I mean, they're all getting budgets cut back, but still the larger libraries that have a little more of a budget to do things?
It's true. And I think within PLA, there's the Rural Library Association, and they're really dedicated to that. And some of the divisions really concentrate on what they can do to support small and rural libraries, but it's hard to conceptualize what it's like when you go somewhere and you hear about a program where, like, we're all going to have iPads and we're all going to, you know, like, sometimes I'll look at other libraries like Salt Lake City about how many copies of The Hunger Games they have. And they'll say, you know, like, we have 141 holds on 90 copies or whatever. And that's just like mind boggling to me. So I think it's difficult to understand the stages and sizes. And even the travel part is difficult, you know, like explaining on how much it takes me to get where most things are, you know, like the Philadelphia element of how long it took me to travel to Philadelphia and then how long it took me to travel back from Philadelphia. Like, that's a significant investment. I had to skip the Morris and the nonfiction reception because I had to get a plane back, you know, or it's another day of work. I take off another day of work, you know, I'm gone another day. So I think it's difficult to contextualize. And also, you know, an example I mentioned in the email I sent you was the things where lot of libraries in New Mexico are one room libraries that are often managed by staff. And how are you supposed to conceptualize for these people how to be a youth services librarian, how to present a story time, how to do teen book talks when you're working in a rural one room library that's open 4 days a week. So that's, I think, an element that librarianship as a whole needs to address as their future. Because we can't all live in Chicago and New York and L.A.
Which again, is something how where social media can help out, that they can bridge that gap there.
Absolutely.
Learn how to do those things. I mean, see like the Storytime Underground kind of stuff, of find and see videos and see how people are doing things and figure out how to do this stuff.
And also, I think you can say all you want, this is my situation, and it's sort of out into the void until you actually ask someone straight up, look, I saw how you did this program in your library serving 47,000 people. Can you talk to me about how you think I could change it in my library serving 47? Right. And at that point, when that connection is made, the 47,000 person will be like, yeah, I totally can. Like, let's discuss it. As opposed to just, who's listening to me? And to me, I think that's a huge bonus of all of that. Someone says, I am, and I want to talk about it.
And one of the things that you mentioned, and you talk about a lot on Twitter, is you like to promote and spotlight diversity. Why do you think diversity is so important, especially in children's and teen books?
Well, and because, you know, the other thing is, like, the community that I live in is an exception in New Mexico. We have a high international population because of the national lab located in our town. But at the same time, what is not an is in New Mexico is that we have a high population of Native American and Hispanic children and teens and people in general. They're a high part of our population. So if we're not offering things that reflect those groups' lives, and if we're not demanding that people publish more things that reflect those groups' lives, then what are we telling those people why they should come into our library? And in New Mexico in particular, you know, if you can't say to this group that makes up almost the majority of our state, we have things that are in your language. We have things that reflect the life that you've lived. I'm not interested. I'm not going to go in there. You're something that's having a different cultural conversation than me. So especially in children's and teens, because that's the time when you were, I think, particularly looking to identify yourself in literature. It's our job. It's our moral responsibility, and I believe that deeply. It's our moral responsibility to accurately reflect what this country and what our population bases look like. And contrary to what publishing has you believe of it all being white people who are straight, they're wrong. So it's our responsibility to make them be better for our patrons.
Right, you know? And I think it's just as important for not only to give something for those kids to identify with, but to show the white middle class,
right,
heterosexual kids, that there are other things out there. I mean, that seems to be what most prejudice breaks down into. I don't understand that. I've never seen that before. And so it's a fear of the unknown. So if you get this in their face and say, look, this is normal, there are people like this out in the world, that is part of that moral imperative as well, I think.
Well, and that's an excellent point, because one of the things we talk about a lot is you never hear kids say, look, you know, I'm not a wizard, so I can't read Harry Potter. Like, I can't relate with wizardness, you know, like I myself am unable to do spells, so I can't really relate to Harry Potter. You never hear people say that, because through literature, we allow ourselves to experience worlds different than our own. And it's easy. You know, I'm personally not a vampire, so I can't understand what vampire world is like. We never say that. So we should never say, you know, my readers aren't African-American kids, so they won't read about African-American kids. Really? Well, they're not wizards either. So, you know, I think that's something worth looking at as well. That literature lets us experience that. And so we have to be brave enough to say, look, here's a story that doesn't involve shape-shifting demons. But maybe you could relate to it too.
Well, you do a lot. I think, like I said, those little snark-filled rants you go on Twitter are often about this subject of something that someone is just saying something insane about diversity and the lack thereof. But one of the things I think is a hard issue that I know you've struggled with and I struggle with, and I think it's just you have to, being heterosexual middle-class white people, is how what are your thoughts on how people like us who are middle-class white people can be good allies and support diversity while at the same time recognizing that we have this privilege that a lot of times we don't, if you know it's there, you can see it, but a lot of people just don't realize that it's even there. How can we use that and still be supportive without being patronizing?
Yeah. And then that's the constant struggle of how to be an ally. Although, you know, a lot of times now, even that word ally is like a danger signal, because that sounds like somebody who wants a reward for being a human. So right, like, I don't want ally cookies. I don't want a pat on the head for aren't I being a good white person. That's not how it works. So even that word, I tend to, at this point, through what I've learned and as my activism has grown, I tend to shy away from that. I think the most important thing is it's twofold. And one of them is our number one goal is to understand not every conversation requires our input, but we can still listen and learn from it. So not every conversation requires my cishet white woman input. I don't have to interject what a great ally I am at all times, but I can still listen and learn. That's really important. And I can let people have conversations that don't revolve around me. And tied into that is boosting the signal, which is the most important part, I think, especially in the library world, is to constantly be saying, these are the people that are talking about this, and I'm not going to butt in on the conversation, but I'm going to boost the signal of these people talking about it. And also, I'm going to listen to what they say, and I'm going to constantly purchase these books and talk about them to my teenagers and talk about them on my social media feed and talk about them to publishers and talk about them to readers. And I'm going to constantly get the word out about that material. So I'm not going to say that I have a special insight on it, but I'm going to continue to let people know that it exists, particularly people who might be in my same demographic. So who might not have heard about it, who might not know about it. And I'm going to point out the diversity in it. I'm going to say, this is a really great book with an African-American lead. This is a really interesting book with a Native American lead. And I'm going to make that be part of the conversation. So I think it's those two elements. It's understanding not every conversation requires your input, but that it's still important for you to listen to. And then when the time is right, boosting other people's voices and the material that they create in a variety of ways, from the social media aspect of it to literally in your library being like, I am committing that when I book talk books, I am going to include books that have characters of color, that have not straight characters in them. I'm going to do that when I talk to my school outreach, when I talk to my clubs at the library, when I create book lists, when I create displays. So that, to me, those are the two elements of how you deal with that. And don't expect medals for it. Like I said, like, it's a huge thing in the online activist community. Like, what do you want? Cookies? Like, do you want ally cookies for being such a good ally? Like, don't expect that you're going to get lauded for that.
Well, and you can also use that opportunity to, not only when you're talking to kids, but when the parents are usually there right next to them, that you're being a good advocate there for the parents as well, to show that that's really important for their kids to be reading.
Yes. And parents, you know, are usually very receptive to that. And a good example for this is always Little House on the Prairie, which is controversial for a variety of reasons. One of the main ones being that repeatedly throughout Little House on the Prairie, the entire series, they say the only good Indian is a dead Indian. And so I often get asked for that book because, of course, it's a book that everybody remembers and is a classic and had a TV show to go with it. And so I'm always happy to take parents over to where it is. But when I do that, I also say, you know, a great book I think that you should read in conjunction with this is The Birch Bark House by Louise Edrich. Let me tell you a little bit about it. It's about a Native, it's written by a Native American woman, and it's about a Native American family throughout many generations in this same time period. And it talks about what life was like for Native Americans in that era. And it's a great book to read with your kid with Little House on the Prairie and to talk about some of the problematic things that are in Little House on the Prairie that your kid is going to ask questions about. Because if you think a kid isn't going to ask the only good, why does she say the only good Indian is a dead Indian? You are vastly, vastly underselling your child. And when I explain The Birch Bark House and talk about it and talk about how it's a National Book Award finalist, it's written by Louise Edrich, it's in a whole series, and it tells about how they lived, this tribe lived, and parents almost always take them together. And that, I think, is a really important thing you can do. Instead of saying, I'm just not going to have a Little House on the Prairie in my library, and I'm just not going to talk to people about it, is saying, and did you know this exists? And it's my job to be able to do that. It's my job to be able to know about The Birch Bark House and to be able to effectively book talk it, whether I'm doing that with Little House on the Prairie or not. And a parent or a kid can say, no, I'm not interested in that, and I can't make them check it out, but I can let them know, you know, there's something else out there, and it's part of the conversation too, and it's here in our library too.
Yeah, I wonder sometimes. I think people in their heads are getting the Little House books and the Little House TV series mixed up sometimes because the TV series is much more sanitized and than the book series is. But they're all like, oh, Michael Landon, we love you, and Little Half Pint.
I agree. I think that all the time too. And I've had parents bring it back to me and be like, wow, this was not what I, and I'm like, I know. Yeah, I know. And when they say it's not what they remember, what they mean is it's not what it's not the TV show, which is what they remember. And that's a thing. You know, then it is totally up to the patron, and the patron can say, no, I'm only want the, that's fine. But like I said, if you think your kid's not going to pick up on why aren't more Indians dead, you know, they are, because kids are very clever, you know, and also it's the year 2014.
Right.
So,
and you can use that book as a learning tool of, you know, this is how people used to think of that. And that's obviously not the right way to do it. And so, you know, as an example of bad behavior in the past.
Well, and you have to be prepared too. That's what I tell parents. You have to be prepared for when your kid says, why would Ma say that? Ma's a good character. And why would Ma say that? Like, and a lot of times parents are caught off guard by that and kind of are like, and if you have the Birch Bark House there, you can be like, you know, we're going to read a book next that talks about. So that's key. So, and the year 2014 is an important part, like whether you like it or not, and hopefully you like it, your kid lives in a multicultural world where, you know, a guy who's hopefully going to be drafted by the NFL came out as gay, you know, Michael Sam yesterday, like this is the world we live in now. So get ready, you know, get ready.
So another thing that you talked about that's related, obviously, is that you have a real passion for middle grade fiction specifically.
Indeed.
And just for the listeners, the people who don't maybe not know, what exactly, how is middle grade specifically defined for you?
Well, and that's one of the things I think is great about middle grade. It doesn't have like a specific definition. But I think middle grade is really up and coming right now, and it's a publishing category that's books that appeal to ages 10 to 15, 14, you know, it can kind of lowball. And that's the great thing about it for me. There's not really one defined age group. Like it has to be 8 to 9, you know, it's a larger group.
Right.
But it mostly focuses, I would say 10 to 14, which as I say often about that, I know that that seems like a narrow publishing group. But that's really when we start to see a decline in readers. So I've never met a little kid that hasn't had, you know, I love reading. He loves to have books read to him. And yet that starts to drop off the older they get, or they become teenagers who come into the library and check out 45 books at a time. So how do they go? What makes the difference? And I think middle grade is what makes the difference. If you can keep them engaged in that period of reading, they begin to keep it as a lifelong habit. So that's one of the reasons I'm really into it is because I think it can be a good gap for when we start to lose readers. And I also think that there's an extraordinary amount of talent happening there right now. I think that there's a lot of really amazing writers working in that genre. And so those things connected just make it a really interesting and awesome place to be doing readers advisory and to be promoting books and reading books and then sharing them with kids.
And do you have any particular authors or books that you really are excited about? I mean, is this is the category, basically, this is like the Diary of the Wimpy Kid books would be in this?
I think Diary of Wimpy Kid is category. A good example. Okay. Yeah, sometimes they grade a little up from that, but right about at that level, which a Diary of a Wimpy Kid is, you've seen, of course, you see 7-year-olds reading it,
right.
The humor in it, which is often vulgar, is funnier when you're a little bit older and get all of his jokes. And, you know, originally Jeff Kinney wrote those as an adult series before they were sold. So it does have a little more, I don't want to say sophisticated. God forbid I go on record saying it's sophisticated, but it has jokes you get more when you're 13 than when you're 7.
Right.
So I think that's a good marker of middle grade too, which is that a 7-year-old could read and enjoy it, but it has a particular resonance for older kids. And I think a great example of that is, for instance, a Newbery book this year, which is Doll Bones by Holly Black. And you could read that as a kid. But as a middle schooler, it's especially important, and it feels different. And to me, that's what marks middle grade. So I think Doll Bones is pretty, which was exciting to see it as a Newbery book, because it was acknowledging that there is really great merit in this title that's very firmly middle grade. I think middle grade does fantasy very well as well, which I think is something it often gets not enough credit for, but I think it does fantasy very well because middle school is perfect for the fantasy metaphor of, you know, you feel like you're very different, you're the chosen one. So I think that middle school is really great for that. The Real Boy by Anne Ursu came out last year. That's a Hallmark middle grade title, I think, that deals with a lot of elements through the fantasy view. So that was one of my favorites, probably. And I think there's a lot of really funny stuff being written in middle grade. There's a series called Timmy Failure, Mistakes Were Made, first one. And they're sort of like mysteries, and they're very funny. I like those a lot. The Fourth Stall by Chris Rylander, which is where a kid solves mysteries. Then you come meet him in the fourth stall at the bathroom, and he takes care of your problems. And it's almost written like detective parody, but not. And kids really like that. And that's a series. And I think those are, you know, it takes middle school seriously, which is a really important thing. And for the diversity element, last year, by far one of my favorite titles of last year that I think deserves way wider readership is If I Ever Get Out of Here by Eric Gansworth. And it's about a Native American boy in the 70s. And it's amazing, and it's hilarious, and it's about being a nerd in middle school and how that's much more complicated if you live on the res and you're poor. And I think everybody knows Diary of a Part-Time Indian, but first of all, that is definitely a high school book. And If I Ever Get Out of Here is very much a middle school book. And it also deals with this, you know, how do you fit in on top of that you have living on the res and being poor? How do you fit in with that as well? And it came out last year. It was one of my favorite books of last year. And it's another one that you don't have to live in 1976 and be a Native American kid to relate with this story. So I always include it when I talk about it. And I tell people, like, you know, Diary of a Part-Time Indian's for high school people, but If I Ever Get Out of Here is for middle school readers. So give it a shot.
So what is it about middle grade fiction that appeals to you as an adult reader? Like, what do you get out of it that you enjoy reading it? I mean, I know part of it is going to be, this is going to be a great thing for kids to read. But is there anything in particular that you think is really appealing to you as an adult?
Yeah, as I alluded to, I think it's not to say that YA isn't, but at this period, like, it's going through a real renaissance. So there's a lot of really great craft in it. So a lot of really great writing that can be more subtle than YA and can be more emotional. So, and also, you know, I think that it allows itself a wider range. So not that there's anything wrong with YA romance, because I love it. But sometimes with middle grade, you don't have to worry about, like, is this going to turn into one of those, oh, my God, we have to be together forever, but we can't be together forever because we're in love. We're not in love. So I think that's sort of a relief after really going through that with young adult. And it is just, I think some of the writers, like the ones I mentioned, you know, like Anne Ursu and Holly Black and Eric Gansworth, like, these are incredibly talented writers. And as an adult, I appreciate craft. And all three of those books, the ones by Chris Rylander, so many middle grade novels are well crafted, and I really appreciate that as an adult reader.
And I know part of what you told me that you did do as part of your job is you supervise a lot of the student workers that work at your library.
Indeed.
Do you see that as a good way of doing community outreach to get them in the library and working in the library?
Well, they're my best promoters, you know, those kids. And I say that all the time about your teen employees. If you have teenage employees, or even if you have college age employees, they're the best promoters you'll have, because they will, if they enjoy working at the library, which you can make them enjoy as their supervisor, if they enjoy working at the library, they're going to tell every person they know. They're going to tell every kid they know, this is a great place to be. You should come hang out. They're so cool here. The two students that I have working for me right now, they're both college freshmen, but they've been working for me since they were juniors in high school. There's a two-year community college in our town, and they've stayed to go there. And they're amazing to have on hand, because even when they're there working, I'll be trying to tell a kid about a book and they're kind of like on the fence, and I'll call one of my student workers over and I'll be like, hey, Jared, you've read this book. Is it great? And he's like, oh my God, it's so good. Like, I loved it. It's amazing. They're effective, in the community too, because they're always telling their people, you know, you gotta. Just last week, a woman from the community college who teaches English 102 called me and said, can you come talk to our class about how you use writing in your job? And I said, how did you get my name? And she said, oh, one of your students is in my class. She talks about you all the time. So I think that's a really important thing.
That's great.
Yeah. So I was like, sure. Yes. I'd love to come talk to a college class about how writing is important. And they would never have heard of me if it hadn't been for my student workers saying, oh, so, and I've had three student workers go on to get their MLIS degrees, because I think it's a thing that when they work at the library, you can make them think, wow, this is cool. This is fun. This is something I want to do. This is a relevant profession to my life. So
that's my awesome. Goal is,
I tell them all the time, if I get two more, I get a toaster. So pretty psyched.
Almost there.
So close. Got to turn two more.
So you also, do you present programs a lot for your teen customers, or are you just doing it for your patrons, or for your, or just for the younger kids?
No. So our teen group actually meets today, this afternoon, so that should be fun. We have a teen program once a month. If we try to have it more often, they don't really come. So a lot of it is hands-on, but we do have a once a month teen program, which is our teen advisory group. And they get a look at all the newest books, and we talk about what we're reading. And that's when I really get a chance to target book talk, which is takes us back to the diversity element, you know, of when I'm doing this book talk, I always make sure that I'm going to talk about some books that have some non-white, non-straight characters in them, while I have a captive audience of anywhere between 7 and 15 kids who are going to listen to me and take my recommendations. And we've also really developed the teen collection. So it does a lot of circulating out of our site. You know, we hope that it speaks for itself. So if you come in and don't really want to talk to us, hopefully you are talking to us by checking out the books.
Right.
Yeah. You are liking what we've created, even if you're not coming and speaking with an adult.
And of course the summer reading program is rapidly approaching.
It's happening.
Do you tend to do a lot for teens in that as well?
We try. You know, I definitely would say that's something we struggle with, because it's harder to get them in the library in the summer, because they're not already going to school. They're on vacation, they're working jobs. So in the summer, we try different things. You know, we had a film series this summer, and we try to have things a little more often than once a month in the summer. But the real thing in summer is a lot of our kids who... we have a lot of college students come back. So it is, as with all the business of teen services, it's difficult to have to start to tell 21-year-olds, you can't come to this program. But, and that is something that I think library services are going to need to address soon, that we've raised a generation of kids who believe that the library is there to provide them with endless entertainment and fun, yet I can't have 21-year-olds come to program with 13-year-olds. Like, I just can't do that. They're at very different maturity levels. So what am I going to offer for the 21-year-olds? And if I personally, if the youth services department isn't going to offer something, adult services needs to be ready to step in. Because these kids expect, you know, they come back from college and they tell me, you know, the I went into the public library and I didn't know what. Well, of course, because you're an 18-year-old trying to crash a 15-year-old event. Of course they looked at you funny. So, you know, what is there going to be to supplement that older teen demographic? So that's who we get a lot of in the summer. But summer reading for teens is constantly, for me, a challenge. And I think this year we're going to switch to doing registration online, which I've heard and I hope will make kind of a difference. But it is important to have a program for them as well. I say all the time, even if 40 teens register for something, we're not going to say, yeah, we don't really do that. We're going to say, yay, 40 teens, woo! Let's make it 50, yeah! Like, that's just an important thing. You can't judge it by the standards of your other programs. So,
right. So, Angie, where can people go to find out more about you and your work?
Well, as we mentioned a lot, I'm Twitter. I'm very active on Twitter. Yes. And so you can follow me on Twitter. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning, I was an early adopter of Twitter. So I used one of my online aliases, which is the name of my all-time favorite film character. Film is my favorite hobby. So I use the name of my favorite film character for my favorite film, which is Miss Kubelik, which is from The Apartment by Billy Wilder. And that's Miss, M-I-S-S, K-U-E-B-L-I-K. And had I known that Twitter was going to become so professional, I might have chosen something else. But in 2008, who could have foreseen? So that's me on Twitter. And my blog is fatgirlreading.com. And you can also Google my name and a lot of stuff will, those two links will come up first and foremost. And the blog is transitioning at this period to a new host. So it's been on and off. It's been spotty, but I hope that within the next week or two, it'll resolve and I'll be able to start posting again on it. Cause you know, fat activism is my other big thing. I'm fat, in case you have never seen me or don't know that. I'm fat. I weigh like 250 pounds. I don't know. And that's a big part of my online existence. So hence the name, and it's easy to remember. So,
well, it's also a part of what we talked about earlier of being true to yourself online.
Yes. Yeah. That you're not going to see me and be like, whoa, I did not see that coming. So, and I've never online. I've been online active for years and I've never ever tried to hide it. And as I got more involved with body politics and body activism, it became even more important in my online presentation. So hence the name.
All right. Well, Angie, thank you again so much for being on the show with me today. It was a pleasure to finally speak to you one-on-one. And I'm again sorry that we didn't get to meet in person, but we will someday at a conference.
I have a feeling. Thank you for having me. I love your show. I love everybody who's been on and I'm excited to be part of it. So thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com. Or you can follow the show on Twitter at CircIdeas or on Tumblr at circulatingideas.tumblr.com. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/circulatingideas. And if you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.
There's always a pause when people try to figure out how it's Manfredi. Yeah, so Manfredi.
Manfredi.
Yeah, they always pause the F. Yeah, the F is the trip up point.
I think it's the pronunciation of the E where you get to the point of, is it?
Right. And you panic with the F. Yeah, you're like, oh no, I'm going to have to say this.
And you're stuck at that point too. You got to go forward.
You have to push through.